I see the idea of sustainable purchasing and public procurement really gaining traction quite a bit. Getting a bunch of people in a room and kicking around the idea, I think, is really important. Having a community of purpose is really important. And I do mean community when I say that. So if everyone's in agreement and everyone feels it's something they want in their community, the question you always ask then is, who else should we include? One area that I think is really important to think about, and it's not always the first one that comes to folks' minds, but is your local elected official. They're elected to serve the interests of the community. By and large, school districts, and there are school districts everywhere, are very responsive to community interests.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
At Clubhouse and also on podcasts, today is a big day to rethink the food system. I've got a special guest for the podcast today, and then after the podcast, we're going to slide on into a Clubhouse room. And for those that you aren't aware yet, Clubhouse is kind of a new type of social network. It's based on voice, where people around the world come together to talk, listen, and learn from each other in real time. It's great. Currently, it's just for iPhone users. You need to connect with somebody that has some invitations to offer, but it's a tremendous way to bring people together. So it's another dimension to add to our podcast. So I'm start today talking about rethinking the food system with Paula Daniels, and Paula is with the Center for Good Food Purchasing, and we're going to have a great conversation about what they're doing at the center, but about the food system, where the shortcomings are and where there needs to be improvements. And then we're going to, at the beginning of the Clubhouse, where we have a farm-to-table talk Clubhouse conversations where people can interact with our guests today. We've had three of the Clubhouse regulars who have been on my podcast before agreed to ask a few questions at the beginning of the Clubhouse room. And it's going to be Ben Glasson and Blake Hurst and Jack Bobo. And Paula Daniels, I am so happy to talk to you today because people talk about the food system, about the shortcomings of the food system, but so much it's just like talk. You get involved in actually putting some action to the words. And that's why I really admire you've done it in so many different ways. And we're going to explain what those ways are. But Paula, welcome. And let me give you a really tough question to start off with. I mean, if you were going to kind of sum up the food system and how it's serving us today, I mean, what is it you can say about the way the status quo is of the food system?
And thank you so much, Roger, for having me on. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and to deal with these subjects. And I would say it does seem like the current food system is an artifact of the mid-century model of industrially produced agriculture. So most of it is designed toward efficiencies and economies of scale. It's designed toward global interaction. It's designed to feed the world and to be a strong player in the agricultural realm for the rest of the world. So it's accomplished its goals. The U.S. is a powerhouse when it comes to agricultural production. But because of the efficiencies and the economies of scale, it's created some unintended consequences, which are that there are aspects of the food system that are not necessarily fully served by it. And a lot of this comes from the notion of what is actually affordable and what is available. So food produced on a mass scale often tends to be commoditized and highly produced. Highly produced means, it comes through a number of vertically integrated chains of production, but it also may lose a lot of nutritional content along the way. And that food is then more because it's highly produced, it comes through a consolidated and efficient commercial system, it's more affordable, but it's not necessarily more nutritious. So then folks that are in communities that have less money to spend on food are also then only able to afford food that's highly processed. And then you find that end of the spectrum of, you know, the array of aspects of the food system struggling to afford healthier food. And then at the same time, on the production side, you find that smaller producers, mid-sized producers, diverse producers, producers of whole produce in many instances are less able to have access to these larger markets. So I would say it's a system that has a number of like previously unintended consequences, but we're aware of it now, and we have an opportunity to rework aspects of the system so that it can serve the community at large.
Wow. You know, that's so hard to get your arms around it, but you gave a really good explanation. You painted a picture, and I think that the people that might be listening to us right now can start getting their arms around it, too. It's interesting, too, that you were talking about kind of like the mid-century food system. I've used to mid-century is kind of in when it comes to furniture and houses and things like now, that the mid-century modern version. And on the other hand, all that period of time when things looked like they were going pretty good right after World War II, there's been a lot of changes, not the... And it includes in the environment. I mean, if we had stayed at the same levels of greenhouse gas production as we had back then too, we wouldn't be in serious trouble. So there's
plastic. Do you remember the line from The Graduate? Do you remember that movie?
Yeah,
The Graduate. And he's just coming out of college and he's getting buttonholed at his party. And somebody says, one word for you, plastics, my boy, because that was the area to go into at the time. And it expanded right around that time. It started showing up in everything as a convenience.
Yeah,
something that would make things easier. But now we know about that. Now we know what the consequences of it are.
Well, yeah, the consequences are Benjamin could have been floating around in that swimming pool where Simon and Garfunkel were singing, imagining an island the size of Australia made up of plastic floating in the ocean.
Right.
And all of those things. Well, we need to pull it back in, though. I'm thinking about the areas that people can envision. I mean, if you're a farmer, you can see the world from your own farm. But when we talk about a food system, it's where food's being delivered, isn't it? I mean, so people are eating. They're eating hopefully more often now, again, in restaurants, but they're restaurants and stores and institutions and universities and jails and nursing homes. And they're getting that food to the places that are consuming it or coming on big, long trucks, which often are coming clear across the country, traveling thousands of miles for these delivery systems. Mm-hmm. And Paula, when I first met you, you were bringing people together of a common interest. You were able to create a tent in Los Angeles, and I attended a meeting of the Los Angeles Food Council. And I was just blown away. It was years ago. I mean, how did you, with such a notion that's somewhat abstract, attract so many people to have something to food that with you could get people that were running institutions, purchasing food and hospitals and local farmers in the same tent to try to figure out how you could improve the system? I mean, you couldn't, what'd you do? Just send an email out and say, once it all come, we're going to fix the food system.
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about the early days of the LA Food Policy Council. And the way we started that, this was an initiative of Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles. I think you might remember that at the time we started it, I was a senior official in his administration and talked to him about having a regional food policy, about Los Angeles being a leader in the regional food system. He completely embraced, endorsed, supported, valued that idea and put his full weight behind it. And that made a big difference. He gave the go-ahead and green light for Los Angeles to be a leader. So it was a strong signal from the mayor of Los Angeles, as you know, a big city in a big county. in a big state, in a big country. But recognizing that LA was once the largest agricultural county in the country, but now, you know, not at all, but also recognizing the responsibility of an urban area to the rural agricultural producing regions. And how do you make those, how do you make those relationships more robust, meaningful, and more direct was part of it around food, because we recognize the economic aspect of a regional food system. And in pulling this together, we worked with a lot of partners, and I want to thank Michael Dimmick of Roots of Change, who helped us in the formation stage in holding a number of urban-rural roundtables. So we, as we were developing our theory and our policy framework under the charge of Mayor Villaraigosa, we had three urban-rural roundtables in the Southern California region and did a lot of outreach there to farmers, to producers, to quite a number of folks. We also had A.G. Kawamura, who was the Secretary of Food and Agriculture, as part of our task force, and had a cross-sector representation in the task force that led to the development of the Food Policy Council. So we deliberately looked for representation from farmers, farm bureaus, from the businesses in the supply chains, to the governmental institutions that are involved in food service or public health, and then included, of course, the advocacy organizations. And executives in those areas also supported the outreach. That turned into the LA Food Policy Council. So by the time we got to the LA Food Policy Council stage, we'd already had a lot of roundtables and communications, and built on that and extended through that network, so that when we had our first meeting and sent out a notice to everyone through those networks we'd been building already, we had hundreds of people showing up wanting to participate. But the thing I want to emphasize here is we had a very focused, deliberate approach to bring in all the different sectors, aspects, and actors in the entire supply chain. And we knew that would be important, and we want to maintain those relationships. Hard as it was for farmers to leave the farm and come to our meetings, we spent a lot of time making sure that they would be willing and able to do that. And I think they got some benefit from those meetings, so they continued to come.
Well, they could have recognized me because I was the one standing around with my jaw hanging open, because it was just amazing. You know, I talked to somebody when I was at that first meeting that was from, I believe it was the Los Angeles County Jail, and they buy a lot of food. And the way they got food is the way most people did, is they call one of the major national food distributors who have very good operations. They look like the inside of an Amazon fulfillment center. Mm. You know, all the food bringing together and then get it out to different places. And the person I spoke to was saying, I really would like to figure out how we can just get more direct local and take out kind of some of the middlemen. So when you hear that kind of conversation, it seems like it's a good direction to go. I would think the people that considered themselves middlemen wouldn't necessarily like this, that some of the national distribution food companies might feel threatened if there is more able come from farm to table and farm to these local institutions and agencies and businesses than necessarily going to a national center and then coming back to the local community. Did you run into resistance from some of those?
This was an area that we did want to have conversations around, because we were concerned about how it would impact all the businesses that are involved in the food supply chain. So we had no intention of harming any business. It was mostly to elevate businesses that could use the more intentional focus on shorter supply chains. So particularly as we were developing the Good Food Purchasing Program, which was a key leverage point in helping to support local purchasing, in addition to the other values we have in that environmental sustainability and fair labor and so forth. We did do quite a bit of outreach and had a lot of discussion with all the actors along the supply chain. So in developing the program to begin with, we again, you know, talked to the farmers and farm bureaus. We talked to supply chain businesses such as regional food processors, and we talked to the distributors. And even as we finalized what we saw as the, you know, the contours of our program and got it to the final stage before it was going to be adopted, we again did outreach and had focus group sessions or conversations, opportunities to vet from those supply chain businesses. Every one of them felt that this was actually helpful to their business, that it was a direction to their businesses. And I'm talking about LA Specialty Produce as an example, one of the larger specialty produce companies, and there were quite a few others in the room. They felt at least it gives them a direction as to what the institutions they were serving wanted, and they could figure out how to manage for that. It was unlikely that the purchasing was going to be direct from the institution to the farm, but again, through these intermediaries, the direction that our opportunity created, well, the opportunity, sorry, that our direction created was to have a closer relationship, that shorter supply chain. So it's farm, distributor, institution versus all the other pathways that they would have to go to, and that it be structured in a way that would be more supportive of the growing cycles and the planning cycles of the farmers. So that's still underway, those conversations.
I want to talk about the Good Food Purchasing Center. I'm not sure.
The Center for Good Food Purchasing. That's
okay,
right.
Okay. Center for Good Food Purchasing. Because a lot of people listen to this and think, well, things happen in Los Angeles that can't happen anywhere else. And, you know, sometimes that's critical that they make that kind of a comment. Others just thinking that's exceptional. It's one of the, it's a huge city, a large metro area. And so they wonder whether you can actually take something that worked there and bring it other places. But with the center, you actually are taking a lot of this concept. It's not exactly the same thing as what the LA Food Council did. But a lot of that mentality and this concept, you're taking it and it's being put together in other metro areas all over. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was a program of the LA Food Policy Council. So the Food Policy Council came up with 55 action steps that we organized into 8 buckets. And you came to a working group meeting where folks were going to go into different rooms and work on different things. And they did. So there was a Healthy Neighborhood Market Network initiative. There was a Good Food Economies initiative. There was sustainable seafood. There was a number of things. And this Good Food Purchasing Program was one of them. And it was adopted in LA in 2012. And we had these immediate impacts of shifting, for example, 10%. They used to have 10% local sourcing of produce. After enrollment in our program, they shifted to 60% local sourcing of produce, which redirected $12 million into the local food economy and created 155 new jobs right away. So that got attention. Again, this was a mayor's initiative, and we had created a food policy task force at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, where Mayor Villaraigosa was a lead. They heard about what we were doing in L.A. and actually were interested, other cities were interested in bringing us to their cities. So that's why we created the Center for Good Food Purchasing. And we are now actually in 20 cities around the country and 54 institutions. And a number of regions are doing as well or even more than Los Angeles has. So we're particularly involved in Austin, Texas, and in New York City. We're in Chicago and a number of other places where all of their institutions, our municipal institutions, are enrolled in the program and moving these same metrics and successes forward. So it can happen in any region.
Well, Paul, so we can help it happen in any region. Just tell me real quickly, where do we people find the information on the Center for Good Food Purchasing?
We do have a website, and it's at goodfoodpurchasing.org, but they could also just type in Center for Good Food Purchasing, and it'll show up. One of the attributes of enrollment in our program and one of the key aspects of how it moves organizations toward success is the data transparency. So they provide us information on their purchasing to the farm level and to the dollar, and we're able to analyze it against our rubric and provide them information on how they're doing. So what that does is it helps them understand where their purchasing is going, and it helps them set goals and make incremental changes toward progress.
I tell you what, it's exciting what's going on, and it's, you can't keep a secret of things like this, and we're not keeping it a secret here. So, Paula Daniels, drop in with me into our Farm to Table Talk Clubhouse room where we have people will start gathering in and asking questions. And a few of folks that have both been on the podcast and also in the Clubhouse room are here and have a few questions for you. So again, Clubhouse is where, again, drop in audio chat, and it's a social network based on voice, and people all around the world can come together to talk and listen and learn from each other in real time. And today they're going to learn about the food system and what can be done and what is being done to make improvements in the food system. So Paula Daniels of the Center for Good Food Purchasing is here to join the folks gathering in Clubhouse today. My goodness, there's been some wonderful conversations, and we have great people joining us. And again, this is Roger Wasson, and I want to welcome you all to the Farm to Table Talk room. And I want to start off introducing Paula Daniels. And Paula is with the Center for Good Food Purchasing. Something that Paula does now on a daily basis and has been doing for years, many of you I know think about, and that is how we can make improvements to the food system. So Paula, a couple quick things. Maybe you could get the ball rolling here. I think maybe first thing is if you could just explain what the Center for Good Food Purchasing is.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit organization, and we manage the expansion and implementation of the Good Food Purchasing Program. And the Good Food Purchasing Program was developed as a program of the Los Angeles Food Policy Council, which I founded in 2011. That was an initiative of Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles. But the program itself is organized around five core values: local economies, environmental sustainability, fair labor, animal welfare, and nutritional health. And those five values form the structure of an analytic framework that we use to rate, evaluate the purchasing of large institutions. And they, when they enroll in the program, they give us their purchasing information to the farm level, to the dollar, and then we analyze it according to our rating system. And we have a flexible array of pathways to get points in that rating system that accumulate into stars. The important thing about it is that it's a feedback tool for these institutions to see how they're doing according to these five key value categories and the pathways within those. And it helps them set goals along the line of those five value categories. So a way to think of it is, if you're familiar with LEED certification for buildings, that environmental certification for buildings, and how there's LEED and then LEED Silver, Gold, and Platinum. If you're familiar with the under the hood aspect of how that works, this works in a similar fashion to that.
Well, you know, you started this back with the LA Food Council, and I went to one of those meetings, and I think I've mentioned to you before, when I went to a meeting, I talked to somebody with the LA jail, and they were telling me how much food they end up purchasing, and they were having to go to national distribution, and they were saying, I wish I could connect so we could get local food brought in. And then the hospitals followed, schools followed, others did too. And somehow that model, you've been able to replicate much of that. And you have other goals as well with this, with the Good Food Purchasing Centers. And Paula, you're not just in LA anymore. I mean, that's where this, all of this got started. But how many metro centers right now are we having the Good Food Purchasing Program active?
Mm-hmm. We're in 20 cities now. It started in LA. There was immediate success in LA. And it actually started with the city of Los Angeles by executive order of Mayor Villaraigosa to have all the general funded departments in the city enroll in the program. And then a month later, it was LA Unified School District, which has a very large, about $125 to $150 million a year food budget. So with the success of the LA Unified School District, it did create momentum for spreading, and that's why we created the center. So 20 metropolitan areas around the country. We're in Florida and Texas, in at least 15 school districts alone in California, but other institutions as well. We're in Denver, New York City, Minneapolis, and other places around the country. And We did focus on school districts initially because they're the largest food service provider in any given region, but also they have a really key constituency, our children, our students, and high level of accountability and interest. Other institutions became interested in our program as well, as you mentioned. So we are also in a few jail systems. We just were by motion directed to work with the Alameda County Jail System.
Well, I see our friend Ben is on, and he's from Canada. Do you have anything in Canada yet?
Not yet. We're just in American institutions, but it can work anywhere. It's basically, we just need to get the purchasing information from an institution and then let them know how that we have a pretty robust analytic team that is able to figure out what's local and what's organic and what's Demeter certified. It's not, those aren't the only certifications. There's quite a few others, but you know what the certifications are that they have purchased from.
Does that include some explanation of what they're doing on sustainability or production of greenhouse gases and those sorts of things?
Our program? Yes. So the way it works is that we, in each of the value categories, we have an array of existing certifications that we have ranked in a point system with the help of the input of the experts on our standards committee in each of those issue areas. So they're mostly existing third-party certifications. I brought up organic because it's the one that's most familiar, but that's one where they can get points in, but it's not the only options. There's quite a few others, such as fair trade certified. And in terms of climate and greenhouse gas emissions and water footprints, I mentioned we have flexible pathways. One of the ways an institution can achieve points in that area is by reducing consumption of meat and dairy products. So it's an incremental reduction. It's 4% from the prior year. That's a way to do it. It's not the only way to do it. They can do it in other ways. They could purchase more grass-fed and finished beef, as an example, if they're able to do that. So there's lots of different ways an institution can go about achieving points.
I'm going to open up for some other questions that people might have for you, but I would like to ask you first, do you have some idea of how many farmers are participating? You've got these 23 centers across the country doing the good food purchasing. How many farms do you suppose are involved?
Well, the enrollment is with institutions. So our theory of change is to work on the demand side of the equation and to drive demand toward these practices and make opportunities available. So we work with the institutions. And then we have partners in a number of these areas. We work through partnerships in each of these areas. So partners in those areas will be the ones that have more of the connection to the supply chain and as well as the producers. So, you know, our partner in LA is the Los Angeles Food Policy Council. We have quite a few partners in New York and in Austin, Texas. In Austin, Texas, for example, where you have, there's a coalition that includes a sustainable food center that works with quite a few farmers. So that's how our expansion works, is through these coalitions in each area. And in Chicago, there's a broad array of partners, including the Food Chain Workers Alliance and others.
Well, I'm going to open up for some other questions. I want to reset the room quickly. This is Roger Wasson. We're in the Farm to Tabletop Clubhouse. We're also talking about rethinking the food system today. And you've been hearing from Paula Daniels, and she's with the Center for Good Food Purchasing and has been living this for some time and walking the walk and getting lots and lots of farmers involved and getting the food system involved. And now I'd like to see anybody on that we have on the stage right now, if you'd like to switch your mic off and have a question or a comment on this area of rethinking the food system, Jack or Blake or Megan or Ben or Ethan. Jack, you want to speak?
Sure, I'll go ahead and get started, then I'll let Megan Blake jump in. So I appreciate the comments. It sounds like a really interesting program. I'm on the Montgomery County Food Council here in Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C. as well. It's a good opportunity for me to see a little bit more of the local. My experience has been mostly in global food policy, global food systems. So one of my questions is, how do you address the trade-offs that are inherent between local sustainability and global sustainability? And what I mean by that is that, you know, for many consumers, when they think of sustainability, they think if you use less water, less fertilizer, fewer insecticides, that you're becoming more sustainable. But that may also mean that you don't produce as much food. And if we don't produce much food locally, then it needs to be produced someplace else. And, you know, that might be Brazil or other places. And so I'm just curious if you're trying to think about that trade-off between local sustainability and global sustainability, or that's just too much to tackle within the confines of this particular program.
Paula, can you answer that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, a very good point. And since you said you're in Maryland, we are in Baltimore City Public Schools. Thought I'd mention that. And I've worked with Holly Freistadt of Baltimore for a long time on some of these issues. But I see this as a win-win type of situation, building up regional food economies. One way to think of it is it's not a displacement of the global system, and it's not an either or. It is providing opportunity to smaller mid-sized farmers who might otherwise go out of business. So the global system works well and is continuing to function well, but the smaller mid-sized farmers struggling to get to institutional markets. And if they're not able to maintain their economic viability, they either are absorbed into the larger agricultural system, or they sell their property for real estate development. So it's not a matter of lifting them up and then taking away from that global market. If you're thinking of like what's served in a school district, I think we can get to a reasonable percentage point of local food without really creating any. Like oppositional dynamic with the global food system. So right now, for example, baseline in each of our food system categories is at 15%, and an institution can increase if they want to greater percentages. But it's not really a trade-off. So even when LA got to 60% of their local produce being, 60% of the produce being local, it's still not at a point where it's going to impact the larger food economy. Let me put it in other terms. I think the food economy in the whole US is like 1.5 trillion. The institutional food market is 120 billion. The school food program is about 13 billion. So we're talking about influencing programs similar to the school food program and getting that to a reasonable percentage. So that's not insignificant. It means an awful lot in terms of supporting the local food economy, but there's lots of ways to layer in the multiple choice food system that we want to move toward. Does that make sense? Did I get at the heart of your question?
It does. It does. And I appreciate, you know, the scale issue. And I guess I'm thinking about what happens if we're able to scale some more of these initiatives, and what would it mean for the broader food system if that happens?
Mm-hmm. You know, the way I think of it is if you can analogize it somewhat to renewable energy, I feel it's like that. It's not as monolithic, but it's somewhat like renewable energy, where you've had these incremental shifts toward more local production, basically, of energy, which means solar, it means wind, it means geothermal. And in some places, it's moved to 10%, and some 30%, and some it's 45%. There's still the very large system of energy production. But I think that's an example of how scale could work. And what it might mean, too, is that if you scale locally produced, but if you also scale environmental sustainability, it might just mean more acres in that, but it just in environmentally sustainably produced food. But it's still lots of opportunity for all different kinds of farming operations.
Ben, I was thinking of you, because you're kind of a system all of your own. You've got so many products you're growing, and Are you able to be able to supply to institutions and schools and so forth? Is there, are there programs like this that might be of interest to you, or does it fit for your outlook on what needs to happen with the food system?
Thank you, Andrew. So just my context is that I'm a small scale regenerative livestock producer. And so I raise chickens, turkeys, forest raised pork, and then have started grazing lamb, and next year we'll add beef. My operation is focused on the more boutique meat industry, and so the price point for meat is a little bit higher than what traditional buyers are interested in. However, I see that the ability to, that as I can scale my systems, or that pasture poultry and these regenerative agriculture systems scale, I think there will be opportunity for institutional buying. If we look to the example of Primal Pastures and Paul Greaves in California, they've just been acquired by Purdue. And so they are at a scale where they, and Paul Greaves, his goal is to scale pasture poultry to the point where he can bring the price down so that it is accessible by everyone. He's in Southern California. So I do see the opportunity for that. Now, the other thing is with my abattoir that I'm looking to do. So I'm building small scale abattoirs for small farmers here on the island. And a big challenge is what to do with spent cows, whether it's beef cows or predominantly dairy cows on Vancouver Island. Right now, they're being shipped off the island to an auction and then sent 1,000 miles down to the closest big plant and then 1,000 miles back for cheap beef. So if we can process those animals locally, then it could create an opportunity to have bulk quantities of high quality, technically grass-fed hamburger meat here on Vancouver Island. And so cutting out a whole lot of transportation costs. In a way that we could probably distribute large quantities of hamburger to institutional buyers, whether it's the local school system, whether it's the hospitals, whether it's private care homes, no matter what. I do see that as an opportunity for small-scale producers to create an impact in institutional buying locally.
Paula, I'm wondering, did you run into other farmers in situations like Ben just described, that for their scale of operation, they may not think that they're able to be as competitive with the volume purchases with a school system and so forth. Mm-hmm. Is there a spot where the farmers are saying, okay, well, I'm in for a certain part of my production, but I can't do the whole thing because I'm not really of the size and shape that you need to be able to deliver to a system?
That's very true. And we do work with large institutions. I mentioned the food service budget of LAUSD as one example, but they are the second largest food district in the country. But they do have different ways of structuring their ordering and their menu planning that do make it very hard for more, the artisanal type of production. But the opportunities are still there. And I think you could find a good example in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis Public Schools, they have a farm to school coordinator there under the leadership of a very visionary food service director who agrees with all the values and has been working the purchasing of Minneapolis Public Schools in this direction for a while. And their farm to school coordinator spends a lot of time structuring the RFPs, right? The requests for proposal, requests for bid, so that it can time well with growing season of Minneapolis. And then she spends a lot of time educating the farmers and spends a lot of time looking at what they might be able to produce. So having a value chain intermediary like that, a farm to school coordinator or any other type of supply chain value chain dedicated professional to work with the smaller farmers on their supply constraints or supply requirements, supply realities, how about we call it that, is really important. And we see a lot of success in the types of situations that were just described in places where you have somebody whose charge it is to work with producers in that scale. Then the other issue becomes price. So that's something that needs to be worked out per school district.
You know, hey, Blake, I want to ask Blake Hurst to speak for a second. Blake, you retired recently as the president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. You have like 100,000 people to keep happy, and some of them farming different sizes and shapes. I'm wondering if you've seen something like this work when you were in Missouri, either serving St. Louis or Kansas City and the other markets, and how much farmers have been able to get involved in the sort of things that Paula is describing here.
I don't know the certification program, because I have some real questions about that. But I don't know the certification program, but I do know of a lot of farmers who are in the close to the urban school districts and are selling fresh produce that they've grown in Missouri counties, you know, that the collar counties around St. Louis and Kansas City. It seems so many of your that many of your goals would be in conflict. And let me explain. Organic is easier, more possible the further north and west you go in the United States. In other words, a farming system that will work in Northern California under irrigation won't necessarily work in Missouri because of our humidity and pest pressure. So that seems to be in conflict with local. In other words, if you're in a place where organic is very difficult to do because of pest pressure and climate, then you're local, but you're not organic, where the grower growing apples in Washington State is organic but not local. How do you balance those conflicting interests?
So, you know, the way our framework is arrayed, it's it analyzes each category by itself, you know, so local economies, how they're doing in local economies, and then how are they doing in environmental sustainability. So there's no real conflicts, there's just choices. And so what we look at is what choices they've been able to make. And they could be local in one particular category of food and then environmentally sustainable in another. So in the environmental sustainability category, again, I picked organic, but that's only one option. So there's three levels, and each level has a different array of points. So more points, the more you go up to level three. But in the level one, just an environmental sustainability category, we have certified humane, we have sustainably grown certified, American grass-fed. Level two includes Seafood Watch, Food Alliance certified, Rainforest Alliance certified, and a few others. And then organic is in level three. Or there's the option to reduce their carbon and water footprint by meat, poultry, cheese reduction 4% from the first year of their baseline assessment. So it's very flexible. So what that means is they know, they already have their supply chain set up. They've already had their purchasing set up for a while, and they know where they're buying from according to their menus. We give them this picture of how that works in terms of these value categories, and then they can start thinking about where they would want to make different choices. But it's usually it's win-win. It just adds in more versus detracting from. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think it does. You know, Paula, one of the things I wonder about how much people that organize systems like this are directing the system. You know, I mean, are they just reflecting what the interest is? People say, get me this kind of food, versus in a role of saying, well, this kind of food is best. You know, for example, or organic or pasture raised or sustainable. And is there a risk that within these centers that they get more aggressive in promoting a certain style rather than just saying, here are your choices?
You mean that some of the coalitions or the organizations that are supporting this might?
Right.
So far, I haven't seen that. It's usually a matter of like helping the institutions restructure their own menu planning and purchasing practices so that they create more opportunity. A lot of the focus has been on local. And there are a number of them are actually doing fairly well on that, but then want to increase their environmentally sustainable purchases. And that usually is a matter of trying to figure out their menu planning and then also their bid process. So the bid process can incorporate the Good Food Purchasing Program. And in LAUSD, they did that. They just, as part of their request for proposal to bidders and vendors, they said, you must comply with, I mean, those, you, as many of you may know, those are very extensive documents that have a number of requirements, including responsibility requirements and so forth. And then they would also build in, here's the Good Food Purchasing Program, and let us know how you think, you vendor responding to this, how you think you can comply with the Good Food Purchasing Program, picking any number of these pathways. So they look at who they're purchasing from, and they look at who, what the potential is, and start making some plans according to that.
Wow, we're covering the waterfront here. Blake, did you have another
question? First off, I'm immensely grateful this conversation is happening. This conversation would have been much more varied a dozen years ago. So with that being said, I'm really kind of curious. It feels like we're having many of the same conversations, but there is a substantial amount of traction. And there are even many more case studies. But I'd be curious if Paula might zero in on what their feeling is, the genuine progress we've had that last decade, and where we need to be going, where what we need to really happen to see progress instead of these same conversations have been happening that's a diet for a healthy planet or small planet or what have you with LePaven 40 years ago. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for being involved for so long and for making the case. It always takes so many people making the way forward to make change happen, but it's always hard to be at the forefront of it because you're moving a bigger boulder uphill. And I think we did come on at a different point where we started developing our program and directing it toward large institutions. So what I can speak to is that I see the idea of sustainable purchasing and public procurement really gaining traction quite a bit, particularly since we entered the field and pushed the boulder a little further up the hill with respect to institutional purchasing, particularly of public institutions, that we were a relatively new entrants on that field. At least in terms of the tool we were offering to them to be able to participate and to understand what they were doing. So the conversation does appear to be not only broadening, so you hear it in more circles, but deepening, and you get more and more acceptance of the fact that this is an avenue for making change. So I think your early work has led to some traction. For sure. And we also are seeing with our data, so we now have $1 billion worth of purchasing data from these 54 institutions across the country that we're enrolled in. And so we're able to analyze it and analyze it in the aggregate. And we are seeing impacts in certain regions that particularly if you have more institutions in a region aligned with these same purchasing goals, that you start making an impact. And we're definitely seeing that take place region by region and in the aggregate.
When I hear all of this, I think of, well, if I was starting from scratch and I wanted to get something like this started, and I'm in some area that that doesn't have something going like the systems that you've worked on, I don't know what to do. I mean, my first reaction would be to try to invite everybody I could into the room and let's kick it around and ask Paula to come and speak. but what do you do if you're in an area, either as a farmer or you're involved in the food business and you want to see this take form? How do you get it going?
Well, you're not far off. I mean, getting a bunch of people in a room and kicking around the idea, I think, is really important. You start seeing who's interested. You see who else might be involved. You always have that conversation of, do we want to do this? Do we have agreement on it? And I think having a community of purpose is really important. And I do mean community when I say that. So if everyone's in agreement and everyone feels it's something they want in their community, the question you always ask then is, who else should we include? And one area that I think is really important to think about, and it's not always the first one that comes to folks' minds, but is your local elected official. I know I said that earlier in terms of persuasion, but I think it's really important. They're elected to serve the interests of the community. And many of them are good people who have the community interests at heart. It's going to be different in every region. Sometimes there's not agreement, you know, with you might not, you might be represented by somebody you didn't necessarily vote for. But that person is still going to be accountable to the community, so they could be engaged. But I would say, by and large, school districts, and there are school districts everywhere, are very responsive to community interests. And there are many ways to engage a school district and bend their ear, if they haven't already thought about it, to thinking about how they could serve the community interest in a way that meets those objectives. There's the food service director, but as I mentioned before, there's also school board members that are either elected or appointed. So knowing that whole pathway and knowing who has influence over decision makers is a big part of thinking about how you could get something implemented in your region and being engaged in that. We're also part of the Urban School Food Alliance, by the way. So while they're working with the largest 13 or 15 school districts in the country, it's something that any school district could look at. You know, they could look at that organizational website and see what's being done in those areas. And I think it's very important for any municipal institution or any organization to see what their peers are doing that they can learn from.
Paula Daniels, I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
My pleasure, Roger. Thank you so much for having me here.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.